Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Forecast is provided by CashFly at CACHEFLY.com.
This episode of Forecast is brought to you by Squarespace.com, the fast and easy way to create a high-quality website or blog. For a free 14-day trial, go to squarespace.com/forecast and be sure to check out their annual plans for savings of up to 20% off. And by Netflix. Watch thousands of TV episodes and movies streamed to your PC, Mac, or TV instantly. Plus, get DVDs by mail in about a business day. For your free 30-day trial, go to netflix.com/twit.
What sort of future do you think we're heading for? How will we live as we slip into the 21st century?
Welcome to Forecast, episode 78. I'm Tom Merritt.
And I'm Scott Johnson.
And I don't know that we would have ever predicted we'd go 78 episodes.
No, I don't even predict I'll go 78 years. So this is a number that we can look forward to twice, I suppose.
Yes, I can't wait to bring this back to you on your 78th birthday.
Remember on episode 78 of Forecast? I don't remember Forecast.
I got a couple great guests joining us today. Marco Cipetta, managing editor of HotHardware.com. Welcome to Forecast.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here. Also, Mark Bursteiner, founder of FTW, formerly of Squarespace. Thank you for being here, Mark.
What's up, dweebs?
It's nice to meet you. Wait, what?
What?
I like the dweeb bit. That's pretty good.
What?
Let's start that again.
All right. Actually, let's go ahead and get into an email from Joey, a.k.a. Moo Cow, in chat, who says, Forecasters, when it comes to future talk, a lot of people bring up the concept of a post-scarcity economy branching off from the internet and starting to invade on the real world. While the impact of free share stuff in our economy has been seen in a couple places like libraries and volunteering and such, an actual currency based on goodwill rather than inherent value of things and standards would probably not go over so well in the short term. But in the long term, what if a non-scarce currency was to gain purchasing power for non-scarce goods or even some real-world items? My prediction is that eventually there will be a standard set up by some big player on the net in which reputation and experience play a part in gaining non-real benefits like free movie rentals or digital downloads. This reputation will probably be accepted in the meat world. Probably not be accepted in the meat world, but instead as legal tender throughout the interwebs as compared to other global currency. And further assuming that all merits are created equal, could be interchanged into Facebook credits, Microsoft points, or even incorporated into an Amazon reward system for real-world items. Ultimately, I believe this free trade that we are starting to see today, powered by advertising, achievements, and plain old love of creation and helpfulness, will grow into a thriving sub-economy that operates independently of the rest of the world and be enough to keep its investors self-sustained. Crazy enough for you guys?
Well, as we all know, not all merits are created equal, first of all. Second
Ask my
of all,
sister.
I like this idea that we create a virtual currency that we could use to get virtual goods. But the downside of that is you still end up creating, you still sort of marginalize people. So you have people who, for example, have, you know, let's say the minimum requirement is 100,000 followers on Twitter or whatever the thing of the future is. And that somehow gives them more credibility or these virtual credits or whatever. What of all the people who follow them that maybe have two or three followers and they're all family? It feels a little too, the celebrities get everything and nobody else does, to me.
Yeah. That strikes me as a "what you talking about, baby girl" type of thing. They're trying to do that already today. I mean, go to clout.com and they're trying to just kind of figure out exactly what your social footprint is today. And we can't even figure that out. Something quite that simple. And to that other point, yeah, you've got about a million people who follow you, but your actual reach really isn't that great if you consider that each of those people who you are reaching are only reaching about another one or two or three or nine in turn. Sounds a little too far-fetched for me.
Yeah, and then you'll also end up with the situation where people that have all the clout or all the virtual currency, you know, end up getting approached from people in the the real economy throwing money at them to, you know, pimp their goods. So I don't know. Sounds kind of utopian to me.
Yeah, my only problem is it is a scarcity economy. Reputation, And experience are not handed out unlimited. You have to earn them in achievement sense, right? There's no, you can't just log into Warcraft and get all the achievements or all the gold. So there is a scarcity, even if it is a false scarcity. It's not a natural scarcity. And you will never be able to stop online currency from being able to be turned into physical currency if it's of any value at all. We see that with World of Warcraft.
Yeah, but there's this issue where the all of this virtual currency or all this stuff that would accumulate to become something that you could use as to pay for goods, be they virtual or not, in the end, it's actually, I would say, harder to maintain or to gain that currency online than it ever is in the real life. And in real life, you can go out and you can get a job and you can earn some money and you can put it in a bank and have it build interest and earn other money at other jobs. And the opportunities are there for everybody, really. I guess that's, you could argue that it isn't there for everybody, but it's there for a lot of people. Online, it's there for cute girls, really smart guys, a couple of celebrities, and it feels like beyond that, there's a real trickle. There's a long tail after that, and I don't know. I just don't know. I don't think it would work for enough people, at least not the state things are right now. Maybe in 20 years, it's a different landscape. Maybe we live more online than we do in meat space, and maybe that changes. But right now, it seems grim to me.
Send us your predictions, folks. If you believe they're grim or not, it doesn't matter. We like them. Send them to email forecastpodcast@gmail.com or post them up on our blog at forecastpodcast.com. That's forecastpodcast.com. I think we'll all end up with one currency and one world government eventually anyway. That's what the black helicopters are for. On to the short-term predictions. These are things you think will happen sooner rather than later, maybe in the next few years. And Marco, we'll start with you. What do you see on the short-term radar?
So I see, you know, being the tech geek that I am, I see a resurgence coming to the high-end desktop PC, you know, with the massive influx of low-power tablets and netbooks, you know, and other ultra-mobile platforms that are all capable of capturing HD video and high-res photos and other types of media, that a portion of that user base is going to want to edit that content, create new content instead of just consume it. And they're going to realize, wow, I don't have enough horsepower in my hand or on my current desktop to do that. And we're going to see a boost in desktop sales, whether or not that overtakes the mobile platforms that have been outselling them is another story. But I think the high-end desktop PC is coming back.
So interesting, Marco. This is the opposite of what we usually get, which is
right.
Everything's going to get smaller and smaller and more portable and more portable. And you know what? I'm kind of with you because the whole time this is being said, I sit here and go, well, wait a minute. A huge part of what I'm able to get done depends on that stuff getting better and better, the desktop side of it. And I need that stuff to get better and better to do what I do. And if it starts all going totally mobile, well, then I start getting limited as to some functionality. And I think that's a great prediction. I think the idea that we're all just 100% sure it's all going to be paper thin credit cards that we're carrying around is possible in terms of some of the technology we use. But where the real work and the heavy duty stuff gets done, I think desktops have a place and will always have a place in some form or another. Maybe those desktops shrink, but their functionality and at their core will remain the same, I hope.
Yep, yeah, absolutely. I fully agree, man. I mean, my history, my background is in film and video. I started in film school, and I mean, every single time that another one of these newer, smaller, thinner things comes out, I'm like, that's great for, you know, X, Y, and Z, these things that I need to actually get done while I'm outside of the house. But at the end of the day, if I end up with the only option being a tablet or some kind of superpowered, you know, mobile device, that's just not going to do it for me. The only exception to that rule would be if the interfaces and the innards, the power, are actually able to keep up with it. In that case, I would adore to be able to really effectively edit video on an iPad or kind of run something like this off of an iPad. But as for the next like 5-10 years, we still need computers. We still need laptops. We still need desktops and towers and all this stuff. And that I don't see a serious coder switching to an iPad to rip open a site's front end or to start working in Xcode. Like if Apple put out Xcode for iOS, I would faint.
It's a really interesting point that you bring up about, you know, our devices that we have, like iPads and phones, are always touted as like, this is as powerful as a desktop was 3 years ago or 5 years ago or whatever. There's always a gap. And as long as there's a gap, there's going to be a need for that more powerful machine to do something. But if it, do you think we'll ever get to a point where this will be there won't be a gap anymore, and this will be what powers a desktop?
I think eventually you're going to have enough horsepower in your pocket to do what a high-end desktop PC does today. But I still think the desktop has a lot more evolving to do, you know, before it's done growing. You know, we need to have photorealistic graphics, instantaneous large, you know, calculations, faster than real-time HD, you know, encoding. There's just still so much that needs to happen on the desktop that the mobile space is going to be playing catch-up for generations and generations, I think.
Well, it kind of already is that way, and so I don't see that changing. It feels like there would have to be some kind of crazy epiphany in processing power combined with portability that would suddenly just make us go, oh, wow, we really don't need these desktops for this work we need to do. There's so much that these more portable devices are doing for us, and they're great, and they eliminate a lot of the needs we had with certain desktop configurations. But, yeah, I'm with you. I think that they'll always be in catch-up mode, and even when it's even far-flung future, there'll always be a reason. You can have the most powerful thing in your hand ever, but there's going to be some big, bulky, more powerful thing over there that does something incredible for now that this little tiny thing will need to catch up to, and by then, it will be even something even better the big thing's doing. So, yeah, I think this is maybe our most accurate prediction we've ever had. If I was to put money on predictions... I mean, we had a lot of virtual meat and synthetic meat questions and things like that. I put some good money on, but this is a good one. I would put money on.
What's stopping you, man? Put some money down.
Yeah, I got $20 Canadian right here.
Uh-oh. Yeah, I need to have some money first to put it down.
Your money's not good here, sir.
Does it have holes in it?
There's no holes. Wait a minute. Hold on. Yeah.
My understanding is all right Canadian money has. Oh, all right.
No holes. All right, let's move on to you, Mark. Your short-term prediction, things you think will happen sooner rather than later. What do you got?
So I think especially today, I mean, this is a really perfectly timed episode, especially today with iCloud getting announced, that's coming out really soon. What we've seen, and especially since this is what we're working on, there's always been this hype about the cloud and things moving up into the internet where we're actually going to be able to touch them, not be able to touch them and just still access them from everywhere. But I think we've all kind of had this incorrect notion that it's going to be a Dropbox sort of a solution, that we're just going to have a separate computer up there. And that's really not what I see happening. The way that we're actually trying to do it, and what I see happening throughout the industry, which we're starting to see today and we saw a couple of weeks ago with Google Music, is these separate tailored solutions that kind of really do become transparent the way that Apple does want to do them. I'm not a big Apple fanboy or anything, but I think they are kind of on the right track there. I'm not sure the executions there, but these cloud solutions need to not be this one size fits all. It's never going to work that way. There are separate apps and separate experiences that need their own tailored solutions. And I think over the next 3, 4, 5 years, we're going to start to see those things really kind of coming to life and really kind of finding their fit. Because for right now, for example, the music space is just in disarray. It's totally fragmented. I've got 5 different apps that I'm running depending on what kind of music I need. Thankfully, now Google Music has cleaned up a lot of it for me in letting me host everything myself. And then I just keep Audio around for those quick songs that I don't actually have in my library yet that I'll go and get and then add to that library later. But even that is a little bit too fragmented. Apple's on the right track. But I think between the 5 GB storage limit and the $25 a year, kind of capping it out there at 5 gigs, I don't think that's really going to be the solution. So over the next 3 years after today, we're going to start to see those things start to make more sense for gaming-specific protocols, for music-specific protocols, and for all of those other things that kind of need to start to fill in those gaps.
So back in the day, this is like 12 years ago, back in the day, Larry Ellison, CEO of – he's still CEO of Oracle, isn't he? Is he not doing that
anymore?
Yeah. Anyway.
Still okay. Is. Oh, yeah.
Anyway, he I will be attention till he, to him yeah, a while. But I remember about 12 years ago hearing him speak about – and I don't remember where I read it or saw it, but I remember it really sunk in with me. He said, the internet becomes the thing it needs to become the day that we can use it the way we use electricity. We can just plug into it, were his words, like you do for power. It's just there. It's a thing you pay relatively little money for, and it's just there, and it's everywhere, and every wall has an outlet. And this is all pre-Wi-Fi, so he didn't really have the forethought for that. But what you're talking about kind of feels like his vision for that, this idea that it's no longer a service or a thing that you have to have another thing for, or a company that you like that makes the thing you need. It just becomes this ubiquitous, everywhere thing that you just, quote unquote, plug into whenever you want. And it seems like that's when it becomes something important. It isn't fragmented. It's about standards of operation, not about who owns the rights or who runs the company or who has the data farm. It's about, and I don't know how we get there, and he was never clear about that either back in the day. Like, how do you eventually get there? But I feel like that's where we're headed.
Yeah, I really agree with Scott, and I also think, you know, lots of stuff has to happen. Our pipes to the internet have to be 100% reliable and super fast, and it needs to be completely transparent to the end user. If you sit in front of a workstation and you want to access your data, whether it be on that workstation, your mobile device, wherever, and you want the same thing everywhere, you have to know it's going to work, and we're just not there yet. No one's going to want to pay extra money for that. We can't have these, you know, 5 gigs is really minuscule if you... you know, want to have all of your data up in the cloud. So I think a lot more needs to happen before those kind of services really become prevalent across a wide swath of the industry.
Yeah, I think what we're going to see is something more complicated and better serving us than just a hard drive in the network, right? And I think we're going to see the re-rise of grid computing and the idea of distributed computing. I think we'll see more than just storage, but actually processing power and application execution distributed into the network. But Marco's absolutely right. None of this stuff happens until we can actually have the internet work like electricity, the way Larry Ellison said, according to Scott. And that's not going to happen for a while. So in this imperfect world where we have, you know, some faster wireless internet coming from LTE and Wi-Fi in a lot of places and broadband with some bandwidth caps, it's going to have to be services that are tailored that you're like, okay, I can afford to pick that one because it fits the way my internet usage is.
Well, not just that. It's just a little bit based. It depends on the verticals too. I mean, for something that works for music, that makes a little bit of sense to be able to have those files accessible to you. And that's why Dropbox makes so much sense. It's just seamless with the OS. But when you do start to talk about things like video games or an app that you're used to using on your device, the last thing the developer wants is to let you have access to those files, because that's part of that experience. That's part of actually having that screen running in front of you. So I think a lot of it comes down to just user experience too. And the user experience relies on, yes, the technical aspect of actually being able to achieve these things with the broadband and with, you know, actual technical roadblocks that we have right now.
Gadget Devil in the chat room says something interesting. He says, I think it's a bad way of thinking. The same way we think electricity is ubiquitous and free, it's not really free. The environment and someone else has to pay the bill. The same goes for the internet. Bandwidth can't be completely free in order to keep people accountable. He makes a good point. We weren't saying electricity would be free.
We're just saying it was freely available, not you don't get charged for it.
Right. It's just something you know is there. If you go to a doctor's office, they got an open outlet, you know you can get power to it. You go to do a business meeting and you're, oh, my battery's dying, can I plug in here? Absolutely. So it's that kind of ubiquity. But moreover, I think the technologies will improve to the point that we perhaps have less of an impact on environments and less of a overall infrastructure need to make this thing run. And maybe we kind of already have this. Maybe that is what the internet is, and that's all it ever needs to be. But it, just like with power, if I've got the power, that doesn't determine what blender I have to buy. I can buy any brand blender I like because I'd pick the one I like, and I can buy a junky one if I want or whatever. I feel like that's how this needs to continue to progress. And it kind of has to this point, the internet itself, I mean. But these cloud services that keep popping up, they need to not be, well, I got to go with Apple's, or I got to go with Google's, or I got to go with whoever's. Right. It needs to be this thing that we can all just buy the blender to continue my dumb analogy.
Right. And no, that's a great analogy, actually. I mean, you wouldn't buy a blender if you needed to, say, make some coffee. You know, that doesn't make sense. You would buy a coffee maker. You know, so in that same sense, we need to be able to have these services that make sense, just that we can, sure, plug in. And it does need to be ubiquitous, but we need to have the right tool for the job.
Yep, absolutely. And time for us to take a quick break. Thank our sponsor, Squarespace.com, which is probably the right tool for a lot of jobs. If you're a blogger, it's got an easy-to-use UI for creating and managing a website or a blog, optimized for both beginners and CSS experts. Hundreds of design templates. You can be as bad at design as me and make a really good-looking website using Squarespace. It's also in the cloud because they host it. They store it for you. And so it's reliable. If you get a lot of visitors, it scales up fast. Or if you don't get a lot of visitors, you don't need to be wasting a lot of resources on it. But then when you do down the line, it's going to be there for you. So check it out. Movable Type, TypePad, WordPress, and Blogger, all available for import. And all of your data is exportable, too. They don't lock you in. That's a key to these cloud services, right? Is that I want to be able to change. If I go from one music service to another, what am I going to do with my music if it's all been streamed and I don't have it downloaded? With Squarespace, they say, look, we think you're going to love our service enough. We're not worried about that. We'll let you take the data if you need to go for whatever reason. So go ahead and give them a try. I think you're going to like them. Check them out, squarespace.com/forecast. That's F-O-U-R-C-A-S-T, a free 14-day trial. No credit card needed. Just start building a website. You can use their templates and make it look great. Or if you're more skilled than I am, you can get in there, tweak the CSS, and make it look exactly the way you want to. It works for any skill level. Check them out, squarespace.com. We thank them for their support of Forecast. Mark, we'll stick with you. Long-term prediction. These are more of the in 100 years we'll be in flying cars sorts of predictions. What do you got for us here?
So one of my favorite articles in any magazine I've ever read, I was much younger, it was an issue of, I think it was either Popular Science or Popular Mechanics. I really wish one of them would change their name, but my dad used to read them.
Unpopular Mechanics.
Yeah, Unpopular Mechanics would be great.
I hate Unpopular Mechanics. My dad used to read them and then give them to me when he was done, and there was one issue that was, in 20 years we're going to be able to do these things. And that I still to this day cannot wait for this to happen. It was this kind of concept that, you know, everything keeps shrinking, you know, Moore's law and all that, computer power doubles every 15 years, and cameras keep shrinking, processors keep shrinking, and storage keeps getting bigger and cheaper, that we're actually eventually going to be able to catalog our memories and have them accessible to us in an efficient manner where we can actually keep track of things without having to root through everything. We'll actually efficiently be able to tag and monitor video and audio based on cameras and microphones that are on our contact lenses, and our phones that will be able to have petabytes of storage in our pockets, that in essence, we'll be able to just catalog. Who knows if it's actually going to be in the cloud by that point, since that's, you know, seems to be a popular topic of conversation for today. But I don't know if this is so much a prediction as it is a hope. That eventually I can just go, holy crap, what'd you just say? And then replay it over in my head. I would never have to worry about forgetting anything ever again.
So great for domestic disputes.
Yeah, exactly. Who would have access to your memories? So would you have to, like, are we going to have to assist a system set up where...
Facebook.
Facebook is it.
Facebook will have access to your memories.
AOL keyword is what we need to have back in place. No, but I mean, like, if somebody, let's say, I don't know, your offspring decide they want to find out what you were thinking in 2011 when you made this prediction, and they want to go back and dig through there and find it, how are we granting access to people? Is it going to be a genetic thing where their markers match, therefore they have access? What if you have a rogue son who hates your guts and wants to use it against you? Like, what do you think about all that stuff?
So there's got to be a buffer, right? I mean, like, I wouldn't put it in the cloud if it were me. I wouldn't have that go anywhere but directly onto my pocket. And at that point, I mean, codecs, video codecs in the next 20 years are going to go ridiculously crazy. I mean, I don't know if you guys are super big into video, but if you've ever seen Apple's ProRes codec, that's what a lot of all the red cameras work with. It goes straight from uncompressed into ProRes, and that codec is just absolutely phenomenal. So it's not going to be it's not going to be ridiculous to think that we can maintain that much data in our pockets without it actually hitting the cloud first. So I think it's as simple as being able to tag people, just like you said, based on a certain amount of parameters, right? So you can actually say, you know, I do want my family if it matches, you know, both my maternal and paternal DNA, and my children, if they match their maternal DNA, to be able to see these memories if I've marked them as such. But at that point, I think it's actually going to be to the point where we're actually interfacing with our data in a bit of a different way than we can really kind of even comprehend at this point, because things once we get there, you're heading towards this, not singularity just yet, but we're heading towards this point where things kind of become a little bit more kind of in tune with what we're doing online. And I think at that point, that's not just going to be cameras on our eyes. That's going to be an OS that we're running. That very well may be our mobile device, and that is how we communicate with one another. And what's in our pocket is just the storage. Or maybe the storage is actually in our brains at that point. I mean, that's not really that far off. But given the amount of, like, if you said what we had today, as far as whether it's video games or music storage to somebody from 20 years ago, they'd be floored. They would be peeing in their pants. So I don't think that that's way too far off to think that we've actually got all of that information in an efficient way to be able to actually tag it and catalog it. If we can efficiently tag and catalog it, then I don't see why we can't efficiently set parameters on privacy, because at that point, we're just running a program locally. We're not having to deal with the Facebooks and the Googles of the world.
So, Marco, you know, how do you see the future of archiving your mind?
I'll take his prediction and take it a step further. I don't think you're going to need cameras on your eyes. I don't think you need to carry storage. Really, all that needs to happen is some sort of neural interface needs to be designed that's tapping the memories already in your brain. You know, as we're walking around, seeing things, talking to people, doing whatever, our brain is already storing all this data. Whether or not we can access it or not is the question. You know, most of our memories and things we've seen is in there. So we would just need to develop some sort of interface for our brains that could then interface with whatever storage or whatever media we're going to use to broadcast those memories. And as far as tagging and cataloging it, our brains are already doing that. You know, it's just a matter of accessing that data.
Well, we do forget things, though, so I think we'll need some kind of versioning system.
Right. I think there's two problems. Sorry. There's two problems there. There's imperfect memories, right? We don't always remember things correctly. I've gotten into countless arguments with my girlfriend saying, you know, I told you to do that. I know that I told you to do that. I have the memory in my brain. I've watched it happen with my own eyes. So there's that kind of imperfection there. And then there's the idea that we're talking, if we're talking 5-10 years here, you know, just 20 years tops, I do agree that I think that's something that's going to happen eventually. But we might be bleeding a little bit into my crazy long-term prediction then. So,
all right. Well, let's shift over to Marco's long-term prediction then before we get to crazy-ass prediction. Again, the more of the flying car 100-year scenario, what do you got?
Sure. So I'm going to pull some points from everyone's answers already. I think at some point in the next 100 years, there's going to be so much processing power available and so much surveillance equipment deployed in public. And there's going to be so many tracking devices in our gadgets or on our person that are all linked via the internet, the cloud, whatever you want to call it, that some enterprising firm is going to be able to collect all of that data. And along with some sophisticated physics algorithms, real-time traffic algorithms, they're going to be able to offer a predictive service where they can alert you to potential accidents, potential things that may happen to you over the course of a day, week, month, what have you, using all of that data collected from all of the people and machines throughout the world.
So you're okay. I love this. So wait. So if I'm gonna get on a flight to Anaheim in October, which is happening. And you're saying if this was 100 years from now and this was going on, I could accumulate data from computer systems at the airport and in ticketing and the people involved there. Their sort of biological data would be somehow mixed into this, and the freeway data and all this sort of thing would help me within some realm of accuracy actually predict how my trip's going to go, or say, oh, there's a likelihood that there's going to be a crash because of all these millions of factors or whatever.
Exactly.
That's awesome. So, I love this one.
So why, though? Why would that go from this massive database where we can actually make a somewhat likely prediction? Why would we take it from 99% likely and put it in the hands of a problem-prone human being? Why would the machines not just interact with one another at that point? That's the only thing that confuses me. Why would we give that information to us, who are likely to make a mistake with it, and, you know, just the errors of human judgment, when we could just as easily reroute that information directly to the plane and say, "Hey, plane, what up? Don't fly right now."
Well, exactly. That's what the data would be used for. You know, if somebody was able to amass all of this data and somehow, you know, compute probabilities of, you know, X events happening, perhaps we could react, or it could be something as simple, you know, the path that you drive to work that day, there's a likelihood that at 10 o'clock in this intersection, this other person's going to crash into you. You know, really, from simple stuff to really complex stuff, the data is going to be there. There's always going to be the human element, so it's not going to be completely accurate. But the data is going to be there, and if the algorithms are intelligent enough to be predictive about how certain things are going to behave, you know, there's lots of stuff that could happen with that data.
This is where connection speed and ubiquitous bandwidth are going to make the difference between life or death, right? Because it's going to say, if you drive down 580 today, you're likely to be in a crash. So everybody gets that, right? And so they stop going down 580. Then there's an update that says, hey, everybody changed their mind. Now 880 is actually the dangerous freeway. But if you don't get that update, then you die.
Well, it's not necessarily everybody would get the same broadcast. It would be personalized to you, you know, based on your behavior.
Yeah, but
as well.
I'm thinking so many people drive the same route that a lot of people are going to get the same information.
Right. Right. So I would take that a step further and say, like I said, why would you give that to a human being when they can make a decision that would completely alter the results that you've already gotten? What I see that as being used for is, yes, since we do have that data, historical data isn't nearly as important as what's actually going on now. And if we're talking about 100 years from now, when we do have this ubiquitous high-speed internet connection, then it's not going to be a matter of, hey, everybody's going to go here and this intersection is likely to have an accident. It's going to be, here I am driving down the road and I can tell that there's another car coming at this intersection who's going way too fast to actually be able to effectively stop. Therefore, this car is going to take over and force me to stop before I get into that intersection, thus preventing what could be a life-ending accident.
Right. So the ones that happen collectively, like a plane crash or, you know, a building caving in or an earthquake or whatever, that would be, everybody would get a common warning, or planes would shut down and 300 people would go, oh, we've averted a crash here.
Correct. The problem with that is, too, it ends up opening a few doors to being able to take advantage of that system, because if I know that my car is going to say to the rest of the internet and every other car on the road that I'm going way too fast, they need to stop, I could then, in theory, just put the pedal to the metal and then speed on my way to work if I'm like 20 minutes late, you know?
Yeah, we're basically talking about, potentially we're talking about minority report level sort of stuff.
Exactly.
And, right. and all the sort of moral implications of that sort of thing. But I do think it's interesting that today we've gotten pretty good at things like the insurance industry, love them or hate them, they have some amazing algorithms, some amazing software that does all sorts of predictive stuff about how likely it is that someone's going to get cancer and how unlikely it is they're ever going to suffer from whatever other injury or whatever. And I think they take that stuff too far. And it opens up some of these moral questions, but we are getting better at it. And the better we get, I think that, you know, that seems like a reasonable outcome and far enough future that we could run into that whole thing. Yep. Problems and all.
All right. Before we get into our crazy ass predictions, you can watch all kinds of movies that explore all of these topics right there on Netflix, our other sponsor. Available instantly, streaming on your phone, on your tablet, on your Xbox, your PS3, your Nintendo Wii. You can watch it on your TV. Instant streaming movies from a wide catalog. The It Crowd Series 4 is available. Swingers is available. Both of these one of them deals with themes that we've talked about on the show today. Swingers, of course. World's Greatest Dad. All of this stuff available, and you can try it out absolutely free. If you've already got a Netflix subscription, tell somebody about this. Say, hey, go to netflix.com/twit. Try out the service free for 14 days. You can get the streaming-only version. You can get the DVDs. Have the DVDs mailed to you. Get Minority Report on DVD mailed to you so you can watch it and say, hey, you know what? That's what Scott Johnson was talking about. Okay, I get it now. Check it out. And you can also watch movies along with Scott Johnston on his show, FilmSack.
Yeah, we just did. We're actually recording it right after this. We're recording an episode about The Golden Child, which is streaming currently on Netflix. So relive your 80s Eddie Murphy fantasy adventure movie dreams once again on
Netflix.
Check
it out on netflix.com/twit. We thank them for their support. Back to the predicting. Crazy ass prediction coming now from Marco. This is just, it doesn't really matter. Time frame. What is the craziest thing you can think of that you predict will happen?
Well, it's not the craziest thing, but I think it's going to be cool to talk about.
All right.
So I think out in the future, humans are going to be able to create injectable, programmable, connected nanomachines that'll be used to not only, you know, combat disease, but also to alter our cell structure, maybe even our DNA. And using those machines, humans are going to be able to modify their bodies basically on a whim. You know, you're going to place an order. If you want green eyes, your eyes are going to turn green. You know, you want to change your hair color, you're going to be able to change your hair color. And then, you know, there's potential there for these devices to be hacked or taken over by nefarious individuals or organizations and used to hold people for ransom or, you know, whatever kind of havoc can be wrecked.
Wow.
Yeah,
awesome.
You have read Transcend, or you at least have studied Ray Kurzweil, have you not?
I actually, very little of Ray Kurzweil, but I haven't read that book. This is just one of those weird things that popped into my head when I knew I was going to be on the show.
You just paraphrased about two chapters in that book down to, okay, to about a paragraph's worth of words. I agree, man. I cannot wait. I hope I stay alive long enough to go to the hospital and go, give me my nanobots. I'm ready. Like, I cannot wait. And I'm lactose intolerant. I have to take a pill every time I have ice cream or dairy. If I were able to just be like, brain, can you knock it off already, please? And just fix that and just be able to eat a boatload of ice cream, I would be thrilled.
Well, yeah, you just get a bunch of nanobots that are digesting the lactose for you. Boom, you're done.
Problem solved.
Nanobots that like milk. Those are great. Those are the best kind.
Nanobot tolerance. I think this is
a great idea, just because, you know, being able to take a litany of problems. Cancer, let's talk about cancer. There are things that nanobot technology, if we could harness it in the way we need to, that is our cancer cure, because these could be programmed to find the right tissue in the right place for the right kind of cancer, and every time we'd be able to take care of it. We have the cure to cancer if we can get that technology worked out. I feel like it'll be a long way off, but I'm looking forward to that day. There's got to be a day where we go, you know what? It's all about these little machines. They know right where to go. Chemicals don't know necessarily. They kind of know and they try to go, but they don't. So I think the future cure for cancer is nanobot technology.
Well, and you don't, it's a safety net, right? I mean, we're realizing more and more that cancer is sort of like consumption. There are many, many different kinds of things that fall under the rubric of cancer. Some of them are virus transmitted. Some of them are not. Some of them are mutations. And so there are lots of different cancers. But what you're saying, Scott, I think is brilliant, which is the nanobots don't care what kind of cancer it is. The nanobots go after any of the damage in the tumors and say, right, we're gonna stop that before it starts to damage things.
Yeah, it's like ones and zeros. It goes, well, that's bad tissue, go. You know, oh, that's good tissue, don't go. And if we've perfected it and gotten over all the mistakes and the errors and the people dying from trying to figure out how it works, we finally get to that point, they'll know right where to go and where not to go. And it's really as simple as that. The machine logic is a piece of this we've never been able to do in cancer research. So I feel like there's actual truth to this. There's actual, I mean, I am no, you know, oncologist / nanobot engineer, but it seems like that should be a good combo.
You know, if we can get far enough to be able to identify a good cell from a bad cell, that nanobots reasonably could be assumed to be programmed to go after them. On the other side of it, though, you were talking, Marco, about, you know, being able to change your eye color or being able to change your appearance and order something like that. That assumes that the nanobots are actually taking over for organs, maybe failing organs in some places, and replacing them. At some point, though, do we come across a philosophical conundrum of, am I still me if I've been 95% replaced by nanobots?
Well, that's kind of where I was hoping the conversation was going to go. You know, if it got to the point where the devices were so intelligent and so easily programmed that they could alter cell structure, DNA structure, what have you, who are you really? If you can flip a switch, you know, and change your skin tone, whatever, you know, what you were is just, you know, the sum of what your DNA said you were at that point. But if that's been altered, is it not you to change it? It's interesting to think about.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's there's a pretty clear line between when you're human and when you're a robot. So I don't think that's a problem. I mean, clearly, if you've still got your consciousness and you're still you, but when it comes down to physical features and what your body really kind of is, I mean, those things shape people. Those things shape your personality and the things that you go through in life. And then you end up with this weird kind of Stepford utopian, everybody's got blonde hair and blue eyes and this nasty place that you don't want to live in. Everybody's exactly the same because they see it as an ideal. So I guess in essence, at that point, if it were me, if that were happening right now, I mean, I would want to change those things. There's stuff that's not perfect about me, but I would leave it alone because that's part of who I am. I think there would need to be some sort of a lockdown. If that's something, that's something that's realistically going to happen. With that information either needs to not be shared or it needs to not be accessible unless it's under very, very, very dire circumstances.
Yeah, am I still me if I've changed my hair color, my eye color, my skin color, my height, my weight, and 95% of my brain is now made up of nanobots, which store my consciousness, but is that any different than storing it in a hard drive?
The other question is, you know, if everybody's going to be free from disease, can order whatever body type, you know, whatever physical attribute they want, how do you stand out? It's going to be such a large group of people that have that, you know, ideal selection. How wild are people going to get when they want to stand out? You know, people going to have, you know, chameleon skin, have you. There's just so many possibilities.
The future of human mutation pushed forward by nanotech. That's a pretty cool idea.
Yeah, when mutation, it's not just mutation, it's evolution. I mean, like, then what happens to us? Then we've adapted to this environment in which we can have whatever we want and do whatever we need or what we think we need anyway. Then what happens to us in the long term? What happens over the next few thousand years after we've discovered this technology? Do we just become these dependent, weak beings? At that point, then we're just not humans anymore at that point.
Have you seen Ryan with his third arm and his seventh eye? He's such a hipster. Everybody's doing that.
His glasses on his legs. That's weird.
Well, it would be super interchangeable, too, I guess, is one point to make, that if you can augment yourself now to be a chameleon or do it to have weird ears or whatever, you could just as easily have that go out of fashion and say, next year for my next treatment, I'm going to do something else. So yeah. I think if it ever gets that fluid, I feel like we got bigger problems. Like, we're going to be a weird society if we're letting that happen anyway. But I still like the idea of being able to. I like the core ideas, which is fix stuff that's wrong, cure a lot of bad disease. But then that has overpopulation implications. I mean, we always do this on the show. We think about the ramifications of these ideas, and this one is riddled with them, but at the core, I like it.
We are always riddled with ramifications. All right, Mark, let's go to you for your crazy-ass prediction. One really far out there forecast. What do you got for us?
So this is kind of using a computer as an analogy. If that prediction were the hardware prediction about our bodies, this is kind of the software prediction about what we put in them just as far as information goes. I have the fortunate position of never having seen Doctor Who before. So my girlfriend and I are watching through it right now. Last night we watched an episode in which foreheads opened up and links were established to this all consciousness that would just instantly download incredible amounts of information into the human brain. I don't think it's quite that campy. I don't think there's going to be any metal doors that lead directly to our brain and light is going to shine into it. We're going to learn things. But I do think that in some capacity, we're going to need to find a way to ingest large amounts of information. And that I don't see that happening for a long, long, long period of time because that is a major, major issue. The more complex things get, the more people there are on the planet, we're going to need to start to figure out these things more quickly. We're just thinking from this context, this only context that we can think about right now as people on Earth. But if we start to come across these things that are everywhere, and like we're dealing with multiple species and multiple types of technology, things that we can't even fathom right now, for people in positions like journalism and research, we're going to need to be able to ingest data more efficiently. So I don't know what the hell it's going to look like, but there's got to be some way that we're going to be able to tap into our databases and our brains and just learn this stuff, kind of like you do in The Matrix, just to be able to instantly upload something, ingest that data, use it, and then get rid of it, because obviously we have a finite amount of space in our brains. I think that's something that is going to be really, really cool. I seriously doubt any of us will be able to live to see it, but in a world when we already have information as accessible to us as it is on the internet, we're eventually going to be able to just download the internet, which of course is going to keep expanding, but we're going to need to come up with a way to do that. I have no idea what it's going to look like, but that's something that's going to need to happen at some point.
Wow. So it's come up on the show before how we, you know, there's the old adage that we use 10% of our brain or whatever, which has kind of been proven inaccurate anyway. And we know that there's finite space, but do you imagine we would have to tap into some larger infrastructure? I think of maybe there's something in orbit that we're all connected to.
You mean in the cloud?
Sure. Actual cloud. Like literally in the cloud, there's like a huge array in the sky. Then when we're given some billion terabytes or something, and it's just constantly us accessing that point of data, saving, saving.
That's almost exactly what it's going to need to be. Because we do, like I said, we do have a finite amount of space in our brains. Just because we see it doesn't mean we comprehend it. So there's the difference of, you know, like, yeah, I see that this new processor came out, or there's a new API available, whatever. But being able to instantly understand it and utilize it, we're going to need to start to move more quickly as a society. Once we're talking about, not even just in society, as a race, once we're talking about, you know, the crazy, crazy distant future, we're not going to just be dealing with it. God, I love conversations like this. We're not just going to be dealing with us. We're going to be dealing with aliens, you guys. So we need to be able to keep up with that. And we're going to need to start to move faster. And it is going to end up being, in my mind, I think, some kind of an iPod, iTunes relationship. You know, we've got 32 gigs up here, and we've got petabytes of information up there. We can only actually know how to use a certain thing at a time. So you check off those things you're going to need to use every day, those everyday second nature things, like how to use the microwave and how to use your computer. And hopefully those are very small songs in essence. And then you've got all this other space that's kind of interchangeable that you can say, you know, like, what's the next thing that we need to work on? I need to learn how to dismantle a helicopter because that's the next thing that's a priority right now.
Marco, it sounds like this is the software to run on your nanobot platform.
Sounds like it. And, you know, talking about it now, it sounds far-fetched. But what needs to happen is, you know, a physical interface to the brain needs to be developed, and an API and protocol that could take, you know, data A and convert it to a format your brain can store and access. So it totally seems possible to me. If you break it down to those simple elements, something like this is definitely going to happen one day. It's definitely going to be specialized because, you know, like was said, we have limited storage capacity. So, you know, if a soldier is going to combat, he's going to have the entire terrain mapped in his head and, you know, all the new fighting techniques. Or that same person could be an engineer the next day and, you know, designing, you know, the next helicopter that needs to be built from the ground up. It's definitely going to happen one day. It doesn't even sound far-fetched to me.
Well, go back, I don't know, 15 years even, and say, everybody gather around. I'm going to tell you how future music's going to go. And, you know, just to continue that metaphor, it would sound crazy that you could store 50,000 songs on a single computer and then take a third of that with you on a device that held that much and it would run on 12 hours of battery life. And this would all sound crazy to people, even just 15 years ago. So, sure, why not? I mean, this sort of thing. This is what tech is. It seems crazy until we get there, and then it seems like the normal thing.
Yeah, I worked on a piece years ago. I believe it was for CPU Mag, and I believe it was Sandia National Labs that was working, you know, on a direct brain interface, and they were able to, you know, have a person control the limbs on a robot using thought, and it was, you know, really low resolution, kind of, you know, think about the leg moving and the leg would move. There was no kind of fine control. But those direct brain interfaces are going to happen, no question about it.
All right, that ends our prediction round. Scott Johnson, what time is it?
Well, it's time for four questions. Tom, this is where we ask four questions, rapid-fire style, to each of our guests. They are not allowed to think too hard about it. They have to answer from the gut. Are you guys ready for your four questions?
No, but we'll give it a shot.
If you don't mind some ridiculous answers, I'm so ready.
Not at all. All right, well, I'm going to ask Marco. Marco, here are your four questions, starting with this one. If one kind of tree could suddenly be sentient and start thinking for itself, which is kind of redundant, which specific kind of tree do you hope that is and why?
I think the redwood, because they just live so long and get so big, they would have just such a huge memory and they would have seen so many things. It would be great to have them be able to discuss it with us.
That one's great. They have good memory. And they would probably say, oh, I was there in 83 when they were filming Return of the Jedi through here, and they had those bikes and stuff. That'd be awesome. Question number two, when we finally get our flying cars, what will be the name of the car what will be the name the car company gives it?
Oh, it's going to be something stupid. The Wing. Something dumb like that.
The Nissan Wing.
The Leaf. Exactly. Number three, if you could choose one current innovation that you would love to go back in time and tell people about, what would it be?
It would have to probably be the smartphone. You know, just there's so much data and things you can do with this tiny device in your pocket. I think I would love to have been the person to have invented that or even come up with the idea years ago.
Yeah, that would be... You may take a camera with you, too, and film that, will you? Because I'd like to see the reaction as they burn you at the stake. Next up, is there a prediction that you made today that you wish you could now take back?
I don't think so. I think I had fun talking about him, and you guys seem to like him, so I'm good with him.
All right, good. Stick to your guns. Don't let my questions sway you. That's awesome. So you have passed with flying colors the four questions. Nice job.
All right, Mark, it is your turn. Are you ready for your four questions? He's shaking. You know what? Are you sitting comfortably, at least? Yes. Okay, that's better. Good. Don't fall over. Then we'll begin. Question number one. When will we finally no longer have cords to cut or paper to clutter up our offices?
Oh, man. 5 years. Come on.
Five years. No more cords, paperless offices. You heard it here first.
No, you don't need them.
Question number two. What will we do that finally gets the aliens' attention?
Oh, my God. Eventually, the radio waves that we've been sending out to space are going to get somewhere, and they're going to go, wow, these guys are idiots, and they're going to show up and beat the crap out of us. We don't need to do much. They're just going to go, oh, wow, easy win.
The Shadow knows Hitler? After those people. Question number three. When will the word dweeb finally be as empowered as geek?
Oh, it already is, man. Come on. It was like 2 weeks ago. I started the show saying, hey, dweebs. I mean that as a sign of endearment.
So 2 weeks ago. That's dubit, past man. Cast. Question number four. If you could settle a planet, what would you do there?
I would probably keep it for myself. And that would be like, people have island homes. Nah, screw that. I got space homes. I go to Pluto and just hang out when it's too hot in New York.
It's very chilly on Pluto, so it'd be a nice change of pace.
I would bring a coat.
That's good advice for anyone traveling to Pluto.
Anyone at all.
Those are your four questions. Thank you, and thank you both. That is the end of our show. It's been great having you guys along.
It's been a blast.
Thank you.
Blast.
I had a lot of fun.
Marco Cepeda, managing editor of HotHardware.com. Let folks know what's going on over there at Hot Hardware and how they can enjoy it.
So we're all over the place, obviously, hothardware.com, but youtube.com/hothardwarevids if you want to see all of our video reviews, our podcasts that we run with IaaS, who you guys work with. We cover all the latest tech news daily, full articles every other day about, so come on by, check it out.
And Mark Bursteiner, founder of FTW. Tell us about FTW. What's that about?
So we're enabling data portability over every single game console that you can wrap your head around. Totally platform agnostic. We want your games to be totally separate from where you play them. So you can head over to getftw.com and sign up for the private beta. We'll be in public beta on Android at the end of this month by the 25th, actually, I believe. So if you go sign up now, we'll get you an account, get you set up, and it's pretty cool. Stop playing on one device, pick it up on another, exactly where you left off.
Excellent. Well, thank you guys for joining us. That is it for Forecast. Scott Johnson, you're getting pretty close to Nerdtacular. Two weeks away?
I think we're 10 days away now. As of tomorrow, it'll be 10 days. You'll be here. I'm totally looking forward to it. So I'm in kind of hyper preparation mode right now, and things are going a little crazy. But if people want to follow how that event's going, find live streams for it, see who's there, check out the video stream, all that stuff, the best thing to do is follow me at Extra Life on Twitter, and you'll get all of the updates. There's hashtags going around. It's about to get a little crazy, so looking forward to that with all kinds of rapt attention.
Hashtags are legal in Utah, everybody. So
yes, they are.
Don't forget to leave comments at our website, forecastpodcast.com, or send us an email to forecastpodcast@gmail.com. Thanks for listening or watching. We'll talk to you next time.
Tell me it's 32 years away.
Wait.